Welcome to our May series of seminars. We are so happy to have back with us Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman, lecturer in theology and ethics at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He is going to guide us through the history and legacy of the civil rights movement. Now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Woodard Lehman.
Thanks, Sarah. Good morning. And welcome, and thank you for having me back for a second go. It's good to be here and see some familiar faces, although you've changed sides of the room, so I'm a little thrown off by some of you. I'm used to people being in the same place because I myself am a creature of habit. I sit someplace the first time and I stay there for the duration. Sarah asked me to open our time in prayer, and I will do that using the simple prayer I pray with our two sons. Since they were wee little boys, they're now as tall as I am, and they at least still tolerate me doing this each morning as I go out the door to the bus for school. So let us pray. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. Today we begin our four-week series on democratic faith, the witness of the civil rights movement. Our topic today is history beyond hagiography, remembering the movement. This week, and in each of the next 4 weeks, we'll be taking a second look at the longer and larger civil rights movement, beyond what historians sometimes call its classical phase, that crucial decade from 1954 to 1964. We will look behind and beyond Martin Luther King. We'll be looking for figures and factors that are not portrayed in those famous newsreels. We'll be looking for scenes and settings that are not reported in the usual headlines. We'll be looking for things like this. Does anyone recognize the woman to the right on the screen here? Yep, Rosa Parks, seated next to Fred Patterson, who was at the time president of the Tuskegee Institute. This is a photo from just one workshop in a two-week series that Parks attended in 1955 at the Highlander Folk School in Mount Eagle, Tennessee, just northeast of Knoxville. Workshops focused explicitly on implementing desegregation in the wake of the 1954 Brown v. Board decision. This snapshot is just but one episode in Rosa Parks's decades-long involvement in civil rights, both as a citizen and a disciple, as a leader and an activist, as a speaker and herself an organizer. It is this longer view of the larger movement, the lost tapes and cut scenes, if you will, at which Julian Bond gestures with this famous remark. Rosa sat down. Martin stood up, the white kids came down and saved the day. Bond, as you likely know, was himself involved in the movement as a young man, as a student leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and in later life as president of the NAACP. He offers this remark again and again and again in his speaking and his writing. You may have seen it in the PBS documentary, Their Eyes Were on the Prize, as a way of calling attention to the ways in which the public memory, our collective recollection of the movement, is truncated, shortened, desiccated, sucked dry of its real life and vitality, and as a critique of the misuse of the legacy of civil rights in the present. Satire and sarcasm aside, Bond's remark is a serious one. Now, when most of us think of civil rights, we call to mind something like this. Martin Luther King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial during the March on Washington, giving his famous I Have a Dream speech, as it's come to be known. But in this series, I invite us to look beyond this great man and that great moment, to moments that are overlooked, because they don't take place in the shiny spotlight of mass mobilization, and to leaders who are overshadowed by King, to this great cloud of witnesses who are greater than the great man himself, Witnesses that include people like Baird Rustin, E.D. Nixon, and Diane Nash. Esau Jones, Bernice Reagan, and Robert Moses. James Forman, James Bevel, and Septima Clark. Bob Zellner, Chuck McDew, Amesy Moore, James Lawson, Fannie Lou Hamer, Jane Stembridge, Stokely Carmichael, Miles Horton, Paul E. Murray, Paul LaPrade, Anna Hedgman. I'm ahead of my slides. I talked too fast. And at the heart of it all, as we'll see here in a second, as this catch up, Ella Baker. There we go. Which, if any of these other figures are familiar to you? Any of those names ring bells? Which names did you recognize? Baird Rustin, okay. Number one answer on the board, survey says. Anyone else? Say again. Yes, Diane Nash. So Baird, Rustin, Diane Nash. Any other familiar faces or names that ring a bell from back in the day? Sure. He's not in this one.
I'm just asking about John Lewis. Sorry.
Yep, he's not in this montage because I figure most people know John Lewis.
He what?
I figure most people know John Lewis largely because of his later political career. And so this is sort of calling attention to other folks. But John Lewis would definitely fit in with this crowd. It's just, you know, you never give the students the easy answer. You got to make it a little tough. So Baird Rustin and Diane Nash. Maybe Stokely Carmichael or Fannie Lou Hamer as well. A couple of nods. This has to do with how we commemorate and recollect the movement. Our central commemoration of the civil rights movement, of course, is the January Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. From our calendars to our classrooms, from childhood to adulthood, we're taught that this man, Martin Luther King, and this moment, the DC March, are the center, the heart of the movement. And despite the best efforts of civic groups, activist organizations, and not a few Christian congregations to make Martin Luther King Jr. Day a day on, as they say, a day of service and community engagement, for most of us, it remains a day off, a long weekend in the middle of a long Pittsburgh winter. However, as we've seen in more recent public debates, commemoration is about material memorialization. Statues and monuments, flags and buildings, textbooks and curriculum. Let's start with an example not related to our topic. Does anyone happen to recognize this memorial or maybe even have visited it? World War II Memorial. Tell us what you know about the World War II Memorial, either from what you can see on the photo or what you know from your visit.
It's divided into all segments of the military. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest takeaway.
Okay. What else do we know about the World War II Memorial?
I think it's divided by European and Pacific theaters as well.
Yep. So it's a half arch or half oval. On each side, there's a portico. I don't know if you can quite make out the words on the photograph here. This is the Atlantic side. So it's divided into the two theaters of the conflict. And there are 50 of these pillars with wreaths, one for each state in the Union. I don't know if there's one for the district or not. I'd have to go back and look to see if they actually included the district or not. The World War II Memorial sits on the far end of that reflecting pool opposite those steps of the Lincoln Memorial on which King gave his famous speech. You might notice this is a box standard white limestone memorial, like style and genre that we find all over Washington, D.C. And here the mode of recollection and commemoration is heroic and patriotic. Let's try another one. What about this memorial? Which one is this? Vietnam? Okay, what do we know about the Vietnam Memorial? Ted, I'm going to make you work hard with your Donahue microphone today, going person to person. What do we know about the Vietnam Memorial?
It wasn't popular.
It was not popular?
Veterans came back and were spit on, booed.
Okay.
It's dark.
It's an enormous amount of controversy about the architect and the design. Mm-hmm.
Can you remind us a little bit of the controversy?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Can you remind us a little bit of the substance of the controversy? Why was it controversial?
Fundamentally, was should we really recognize it was part of it.
Okay.
And then the flat wall, it needed more texture. Mm-hmm. You know, how to distinguish those of rank and those not of rank. I mean, there were, it just went on. It took about, 2 years to get even a resolution on the design.
Mm-hmm. So there was all kinds of controversy, from politics and public life to just the aesthetics. What does this thing look like? This doesn't look like the other memorials on the mall. You know, if this was Sesame Street or, you know, the electric company, it would be one of these things is not like the other. One of these things doesn't belong. Mm-hmm. So because it sits below grade, it looks almost like a kind of incision, a slash. We might say a scar on the mall. So as you said, the origin and design and eventual construction of the Vietnam Memorial, often colloquially just referred to as the wall, was controversial. Again, it's adjacent to the Lincoln Memorial. It was designed by Maya Lin, a Chinese American who was an undergraduate student at Yale when she won the design competition. I don't know what you were doing with your undergraduate career. I was not winning nationwide international design competitions. And it was controversial for the reasons that we just mentioned and more. It's black marble. Someone said it's dark. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
That created enormous controversy.
Yeah, so China was, of course, aligned with the Communist Bloc, was on the other side of the conflict in Vietnam. Yeah, we just need the microphone so people online can hear what we're chatting about.
When we were there, we could see ourselves reflected in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important feature of the memorial. It's highly reflected, it's polished, so that when you stand in front of it, except I suppose at night, you yourself are part of the experience of visiting the memorial. You'll often see moving pictures of gentlemen in, you know, BDU fatigues with their head sort of down and their hand touching the name of one of their fallen comrades. What else?
I think the wall also reflects part of the song Peter, Paul, and Mary sang. Where have all the young men gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn?
Yeah, so inscribed on these two walls that meet in a V are simply the names of every person killed in action in order by year. Not hierarchically by, you know, these were the generals, the colonels, the majors, and these are the buck privates in the courtroom. So there's a certain interesting egalitarian dimension to the way in which none of the casualties is greater or lesser than the other. And the powerful experience of visiting the wall is finding those names to which you have connection. For some of us, that means finding our fathers or our grandfathers. For me, my father never got his draft number called, thank God, because I probably wouldn't be here. But when I went on my eighth grade social studies Washington, D.C. trip, I had the three names of guys from basic training that he had been with who had eventually gotten shipped off and killed somewhere in those jungles. And I went to the kiosk and I got my paper and you trace over the name with a pencil and you get a rubbing of it that I brought back to my father. So here the mood and mode of memory is not heroic. The commemoration is not of the bravery, the valor, the victory, because we didn't win, of these men, but rather simply the sacrifice. I don't know if the architect specifically had the Peter, Paul, and Mary song in mind. That's an interesting connection. If she didn't, she should have. Because again, it's that question, where have all the young men gone? And you can walk down one side and up the other. When you start, the slabs are small, maybe as high as your shin. And as they go to the middle, they're over your head.
The first time I visited, because I've taken other people who want to see it there, the gentleman from the National Park Service who was there that day, it came out in his conversation that he was a veteran from Vietnam. And I asked him, does that make it harder or easier for you to be here? And his answer was so short and profound. He said, yes. Both.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that has unfolded as the memorial was constructed, installed, and visited is that a lot of that controversy sort of dissipated. Veterans groups who were originally averse or opposed to this memorial for any of the several reasons we mentioned, having experienced its power, having gone along that wall and found their comrades' names, have come to love the wall, have come to see it as, yes, tragic, but as appropriately commemorating their service and their sacrifice. Now that we're warmed up with this material cultural analysis of memorials, let's look at one closer to our topic. This is the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, also on the mall, also down on that end by the reflecting pool across the tidal basin from Jefferson and up the way from Lincoln. So King sort of stands between Jefferson, the aspiration of all being created equal and having equal rights, and Lincoln, at least the first step towards realizing that aspiration, the great emancipator. Although plans were begun for the King Memorial way back in 1996, it was not completed until 2011. This is largely because it took a while to raise money. King is the first African American commemorated with a memorial on the mall, and he's only the fourth non-president. I should have looked up who the other three are, so don't ask that question. I don't know that one. Once more, what do you notice about the memorial, either from the photograph here on the screen or from having seen it in person yourself? Ted, you're going to earn your money today. You're going to get those steps in.
It's unfinished.
Okay. Say why and how.
Well, it looks like there's still more work to be done, which is very true.
So the statue is in a certain sense incomplete. It's carved out of this rock, but not finished in 365 degree perspective. What else?
He's emerging from something hard.
Okay. Okay. It's white stone, so that there's sort of but I think that, I don't know if that's by statute. I wonder if there's, you know, sort of guidelines for what kinds of materials you can and can't use on the mall.
The way his arms are crossed, it's like, I guess that looks determined.
Okay.
It's very strong.
Mm-hmm. His posture is resolute.
He's larger than life.
Larger than life, 30 feet tall.
It's very rough. It's large, it's robust. But I always thought the unfinished part of it was symbolic of the work to be continued.
Yeah, I think that first remark and that last remark tie together. I don't know if you can make it out on the slide or not, but the inscription on the bottom of this block of stone out of which King is carved is a line from the I Have a Dream speech, which is folded and held in his hand And it says, out of a mountain of despair, a stone of hope. So the style of the rendering is both echoing, reflecting, rearticulating that line from the speech. Out of a mountain of despair is carved a stone of hope. In this case, King himself. But I think your remarks are right to say there's also an air of unfinished business. King himself said in that famous speech, America has defaulted on a promissory note, and we are here to collect. There's a certain sense in which that payment has not been paid in full, although I think we might say a very significant down payment has been made, largely through the activity of the civil rights movement. Around King's 30-foot statue is a grove of cherry trees that have the beautiful blossoms around about this time of year. For those of us with allergies, as we were talking beforehand, this is not the time to visit because it will make your nose go crazy with pollen. And around that plaza are inscriptions of 14 other lines from King's speeches and sermons. But nowhere on the grounds of the memorial is there a name or likeness of anyone but King. So it is King alone who is the stone of hope hewn from the mountain of despair. We read here the official statement from the committee that organized the monument. I'll read it aloud since I'm not sure you'll be able to see it. The committee said, Dr. King championed a movement that draws fully from the deep well of America's potential for freedom, opportunity, and justice. His vision of America is captured in his message of hope and possibility for a future anchored in dignity, sensitivity, and mutual respect. A message that challenges each of us to recognize that America's true strength lies in its diversity of talents. The vision of a memorial in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. is one that captures the essence of his message, a message in which he so eloquently affirms the commanding tenets of the American dream: freedom, democracy, and opportunity for all. A noble quest that gained him the Nobel Peace Prize, and one that continues to influence people and societies throughout the world. Upon reflection, we are reminded that Dr. King's lifelong dedication to the idea of achieving human dignity through global relationships of well-being has served to instill a broader and deeper sense of duty within each of us, a duty to be both responsible citizens and conscientious stewards of freedom and democracy. Take a moment to take in those words. If you're able to see it on the screen, scan over the statement by the organizing committee. What stands out to you in their portrayal of King and in their self-described mission to make this memorial? What kind of story are they telling? What kind of memorial are they building?
That we're all different, we're all separate, but we're all one. That's a hope, it's an aspiration, but it's a truth.
So there's an aspiration for unity in diversity?
Well, I'm still mulling here, but it's at once global and national. It's also, it's very aspirational. But it's also the sort of comment that you see on presidential monuments, mm-hmm. which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, if you changed a couple of the historical details, you can slap this on a monument for any one of several of our more memorable presidents, which probably is intentional to try to put King into that pantheon of democratic heroes. What else?
It seems like they're working really hard to ground it in American ideals. So that it feels very universal.
Anything else? Yeah.
Personal. Mm-hmm. It has a personal ring.
Yeah. So they call each of us to account. They use that phrase towards the end, duty, that we're obliged by King's memory to take up his cause, to continue to chip away at that stone of despair so that the, or mountain of despair, excuse me, so that stone of hope may be fully quarried. Anything else? What about what goes missing from this statement? What don't they say? What don't they talk about?
I just said it doesn't mention race. So this really could apply to all the things that divide us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a passing reference to diversity, but nothing of the substance of race and racism, of segregation, Jim Crow, none of the real particulars of the struggle. So it sort of hands back to a wider angle panoramic account rather than a tightly framed account of the actual history. In many ways, the story that the MLK Memorial tells is, in effect, our official national memory of the movement. As I said a moment ago, notice again what goes missing. There's no talk of slavery and segregation, injustice, racism, no talk of the struggle of nonviolent direct action and the violent repression that it often met. So here we have a standard American democratic hagiography. St. Martin, the great man, larger than life, quite literally in the memorial. And we also have a historiography of the great nation, America, whose ideals and aspirations are true and good, and that ever march forward in progress. Let's do one more, a rather different recollection and commemoration, one that might be less well known. Does anyone recognize this memorial? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, its official title is the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. In Montgomery, Alabama, it's more colloquially known as the Lynching Memorial. And that's because, as you see here, hanging from the ceiling are metal slabs that you might regard as coffins, one for each of the several counties in which lynchings took place from basically the 1600s through the latter part of the 20th century. This memorial opened in 2018, and it is founded and funded by the Equal Justice Initiative. And it's one part of a wider museum complex called the Legacy Museum. The legacy in question being from enslavement to mass incarceration. Has anyone been to this memorial? I've not been to Montgomery since it's opened. I hope to get there someday. The main memorial is, as I said, this shed with 805 steel boxes, one for each county. And it sits below grade, sort of like the Vietnam Wall. So it is sort of a tomb or mausoleum. It also now includes the statue Rise Up by Hank Willis Thomas. And here again, the contrast between the Lynching Memorial and the Martin Luther King Memorial sort of parallels that between the World War II and Vietnam memorials. Here, the tone is tragic rather than heroic. The mood is somber rather than congratulatory. What we learn, I think, from these monuments and memorials is that how we remember is as important as what or whom we remember. In this series, we will be working toward what historian Ronald Takaki calls a larger memory, the memory of those behind and beyond King. We'll be building up to what post-Holocaust theologian J.B. Metz calls dangerous memory. Memory that makes demands on us, that breaks through the hearts of our lives with insights for the present. We'll be wrestling with what James Baldwin often calls our more beautiful and terrible history. To do so, we will explore the larger and longer story, that goes beyond Montgomery, Birmingham, Selma, and Washington, D.C. That includes places like Little Rock, Nashville, Greensboro, Greenwood, and Atlantic City. We'll unravel this longer narrative that goes beyond Martin Luther King and his ministerial associates in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to include Ella Baker and her comrades in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When we do this work of recollection and re-narration, a very different picture emerges. We see that long before we get to those memorable moments of mass mobilization, there were untold hours, days, weeks, months, and indeed long years forgotten of this sort of grassroots organization, beginning in the late 1920s and early 1930s. We'll come to understand that scenes like this are far more representative and emblematic of the movement than the flashy photographs of King on the Lincoln Memorial. In this particular instance, we see Bob Moses leaning on the porch rail to the right, SNCC's lead organizer in the Mississippi campaign. He's accompanied by two student workers who were there for the summer on their summer break, Mike Miller, cigarette in hand, and Martha Prescott leading by the tree. These three young people, Moses himself was on leave from his graduate program in mathematics. These students were going door to door, house to house, as they would sometimes say, building trust, nurturing relationships, and organizing local chapters of SNCC's voter registration campaign. Door to door, house to house, one family, one person, one community at a time. All without the headlines and the hype, entirely absent the newsreels and the notoriety. Even so, as with King and the DC March, so too with Baker and the Mississippi Freedom Project. We must resist temptations to romanticize these student organizers, because sacralization of their memory creates sterilization of their legacy. Hagiography and romance make their memory all too safe and not at all dangerous in the sense that Metz develops. As Wesley Hogan, a leading historian of the movement, tells us in her book, Many Minds, One Heart, the remarkable lessons provided by SNCC, and SNCC again is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, need to be excavated from this sacred ground. It was not perfect, but it happened. Hogan's caution is not just an intellectual admonition about how to do history. It's practical instruction. What actually is real is far more powerful than what might be merely ideal. Put differently, the perfect should never be the enemy of the good. So let's start our work of excavation with what really happened on that bus in Montgomery in 1955. On most renditions of Rosa Parks' story, she simply and spontaneously took her stand. Well, kept her seat. Without premeditation, forethought, or planning, she just decided that afternoon, I've had enough. I can't do it this time. Nothing, however, could be further from the truth. The real story before that famous day on the bus goes something like this. Jane Theo Harris has written a brilliant biography called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. It's great. If you like biographies, get this for the beach this summer. So in the early 1940s, E.D. Nixon founded the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP. Nixon had been a Pullman porter, a Black domestic servant on the train cars, who, having never before left Mississippi, was shocked on his first trip north when he arrived in St. Louis at the terminal. And he could walk where he wanted to walk. He could dine where he wanted to dine because St. Louis was not segregated the way Mississippi was. This awakened him to the legacy of the Pullman Porter Union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, organized by A. Philip Randolph in the 1920s. And Nixon became involved and became politically active, founding the NAACP chapter in Montgomery and beginning to organize voter registration among African Americans there. In 1943, he recruited Rosa Parks to join as the recording secretary for the local chapter. In 1943 and 1945, Parks helped organize this voter registration campaign, teaching citizens how to pass the poll test, helping to pool money to pay the poll tax, oftentimes finding a cold shoulder at the courthouse. Oh, I can't take your tax today, come back tomorrow. No, you got the test wrong, when she knew that the person taking it had gotten the answers right. So for 2 years, she was working with the local NAACP on voter registration. In both 1945 and 1946, she attended an NAACP National Leadership Conferences organized by Ella Baker, who we saw a moment ago. In 1947, she gave a plenary speech at the statewide NAACP conference in Alabama. And in 1949, she founded the National NAACP Youth Council, that is the young person's wing of the NAACP. And as we saw on our title slide, from July 24th to August 6, 1955, she was at that workshop at the Highlander Folk School. So far from being a spontaneous or accidental angelic heroine, as the tale is told, she's instead a well-trained, highly organized activist. Only after all of this, this decade of NAACP activism in Montgomery and across Alabama, as well as that two-week training on desegregation at Highlander, only then did Rosa Parks rebel and refuse to give up her seat that December 1st. However, even this accounting is not the whole story. As some of you no doubt know, months earlier in March, Claudette Colvin, a young teenager returning from school, refused to move from her seat and was arrested. In this case, merely sitting in the same row as a white person. Claudette Colvin later explained, quote, "If she sat down in my row, then I was her equal." After this arrest, Parks, among others in the local NAACP chapter, organized funds to bail her out of jail and to retain legal counsel to fight, because this would have to be after Brown v. Board, so this was a case ripe for a legal challenge. So why was it Parks and not Colvin who became the face of the Montgomery bus protests? Anyone know the story of Claudette Colvin? Colvin was 15, unmarried and pregnant, which in the 1950s was not nearly as looked kindly upon as perhaps it is today. So because of that, the NAACP declined to use her as a test case. They worried, probably correctly, that her status as an unwed mother would be all the talk of the town and would distract from the legal and political issue of equal rights. This is a case in which prudence, what works, took center stage, and justice, what was right, had to step to the side, at least for the moment. So as we scratch beneath the surface, as we excavate this story of civil rights, particularly of the Southern, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the first and biggest things we discover is the drastic tension between the dramatic contestations of civil disobedience and a contestation about the nature of leadership within the movement itself. Barbara Ransby, another historian, describes this tension and contestation in terms of what she calls the preacher versus the organist. King, of course, is the preacher, who in a 1954 report to the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church says this: leadership never ascends from the pews to the pulpit. It descends from the pulpit to the pews. This reflects the characteristic leadership style of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, sometimes described negatively as a preacherocracy. And I suppose the first response is to ask King, if leadership never ascends from pew to pulpit, where do all the preachers come from? Do they just pop magically, like genie, out of the pulpit, fully formed, fully mature, fully trained, ready to go? A second, more serious response is to note the tension in King's own report. The pastor's authority, of course, stems from the congregation itself, who calls the pastor, and also from their willingness to follow where led. Ransby underscores this stark contrast to Ella Baker's understanding of leadership. We'll learn a lot about Baker in the weeks to come, but Baker was a longtime field secretary. That is, someone who went out and about organizing local chapters, first for the NAACP, later for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and eventually, and most importantly, for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. As a grassroots organizer, her view, her style, her mode of leadership was not pulpit to pew, but rather bottom up. She says, strong people don't need strong leaders. I've always thought that what is needed is the development of people who are interested not so much in being leaders as in developing leadership in others. We'll fill out the substance of that statement in weeks to come. But the difference between these two styles of leadership, I think, is obvious. The conflict is not just interpersonal, Ella versus Martin, but populist, in the now almost irretrievably good sense of that word, versus elitist. In closing, we can summarize and schematize these different techniques and styles of leadership like this. For King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, leadership tends to be charismatic in style. The fiery orator, the passionate spokesperson, and we might pause to add at this point in time, primarily spokesmen. There's a very strong gender dynamic here. It's hierarchical in organization, pulpit to pew. The spirit of leadership is deferential. Followers defer to leaders. We do what we're told. It's bureaucratic in operation, and its focus is in mass mobilizing, these big events with tens of thousands of people turning up in Selma, in DC, and elsewhere. It's oratorical in expression. Its characteristic speech is the big talk, whether that's a sermon at a church or a speech in public. And it's messianic in temperament. The great leader is here to deliver and lead us to the promised land. In contrast, the style and techniques of leadership pioneered by Ella Baker for decades and really implemented in fullest form with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is democratic in style, horizontal in organization. From the first day you walk through the door, you are some kind of leader, and each day you grow in leadership. In that case, it's developmental in spirit. It takes people from where they are and brings them along in growth. It's pragmatic in operation. It's not about committees and reports and studies. It's about how do we get folks together and get something done? Its execution is organizing, that smaller one-by-one, town-by-town, person-by-person style, rather than trying to get tens of thousands out at once, although that town-by-town, one-by-one does build up over time into that bigger turnout. Its characteristic expression is conversational. We saw that in the photograph of the three voter campaign registers leaning on the porch rail, having a WeChat with their neighbors. And it's prophetic in temperament. Not one person here to save us all, but all of us together. Now, we'll flesh out these styles of political activism and leadership that they generate in fuller theological detail as we go over the next few weeks. But since we're just getting started today, I wanted to leave plenty of time now for some conversation and questions. What's on your mind? What questions come up after this introduction? What things do you want to be sure we look at as we go forward? Yeah, so today we might look on the television at the headlines, in the newspaper at the hashtags on social media, and see some of the same dynamics, albeit with respect to different issues and events. You can take your pick, Ted, back to front, front to back.
Earlier on, when you were showing that wonderful but large Martin Luther King sculpting, the quick thought I had was it might be better if there were a few folks surrounding him, mm-hmm. behind or with. It was very, dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is just a quick Westminster connection. Okay. As I was going through the archives this week, I found and have now placed in a cabinet on the other side of the church John Galbraith's staff member credential from Montgomery. Our pastor went on the marches. We lost members over it. I don't know if anybody's told you this. We lost members, but he went to the session and said, I understand.
So he would have been a member of the Montgomery Improvement Association? Is that what the...
I'm not sure what committee it was, but he was very involved. They were told carry rolls of nickels in case you have to come. Mm-hmm. But he went to the session and said, listen, I'll understand if this church is upset about this, but my conscience is telling me I must go. And while we did lose some members, to the credit of the session of this church in those days, the session said, John, go with our blessing.
I did not know you guys had that local connection. That's very cool.
I'm sure we all remember where we were the night Martin Luther King was killed. And it, because of his position being so central, it almost felt like that's the end. Mm-hmm. And there were other people who rose up, but it didn't, I'm not sure I can exactly say what I'm thinking here, but it was such a blow. And that, I think, is one of the defects of that particular way of doing things. Mm-hmm. So had it been more, democratic, as you say, then we might not have lost the momentum as we sort of did.
Yeah, that's an astute point. So Ernesto Cortez, who is he's probably retired now. I should check what Ernie's up to. But for a long time, he was the lead organizer for the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is a nationwide faith-based organizing movement, and he has a famous phrase that he says everywhere. He says, the problem with charismatic leaders is that they die. Whether they get gunned down on account of their convictions or they just go the way of the flesh and pass. So we'll circle back to the what happened at the end and why did it end. And it surely did have a lot to do with too many of the eggs being in the Martin Luther King basket, such that when that basket got smashed, there wasn't a whole lot left. But there's also more to it on the other side in terms of the ways in which the successful organizing that had led up to that point took a turn, and SNCC itself sort of moved away from some of those activities and paid the price.
What are the dates for being a Vietnam veteran? Where did it start and when did it stop?
Ooh, that's a good question. So 75 is a helicopter out of Saigon. Does anyone know the first KIA for Vietnam? The French get attacked at Dien Bien Phu in 55, and that sort of starts the whole civil war going.
I graduated from college in 66. Right? She's my calendar.
Yeah, always talk to the fact checker.
Anyhow, I got drafted about 2 months after I graduated from college. They sent me to basic training and advanced training because I was an architect and they considered me to be construction. And they sent me to a fort out in Missouri where they taught people how to be engineers.
Okay.
Even after Penn State didn't. I was there for, by the end of the first year, I was given an assignment and they sent me to where I was stationed for the rest of my military career. I went to Panama. They sent me to Panama and I worked in an architectural office there for a year and a half or so. My wife joined me down there. We have, anyhow, they wanted me to pay for her to fly home and I didn't want to. So we drove home.
Oh, wow.
We drove home from Panama to Pittsburgh in an MG Midget.
Wow.
Two seats and nothing else. I don't know. Somehow I think I'm a Vietnam veteran, but I never went there. I didn't let anybody think that I went there. I felt like I got away with something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still alive.
Could you go back and put up that slide previous that had all of
the different leadership styles?
Yes, leadership styles.
All right. I'll take a minute for everything to pop up.
I was just looking at that and thinking, what a great organizational, I'm even looking at it from a personal standpoint of like the church, and how wouldn't it be nice if we followed that?
Yeah, so you're cheating, you're cutting to the end of the fourth week. So bravo, well done. So when I teach some of this stuff, either I teach a whole class on, you know, movements and political things, and other times just parts of other courses touch on this. And sort of when we get to the end, either of that unit or the whole course, I say to the students, I say, you may not fancy yourself an activist. You may not ever turn up to the meeting, to the march, to the protest. But even if you set that aside, this is an incredibly powerful way to think about pastoral leadership and leadership development in a congregation. You know, you can go door to door, not to register voters, but to, you know, as the Methodists put it, inquire after the souls of your sheep. You know, how is it with your soul? And together, you know, you build up from those one-on-one, patient, laborious, sometimes tedious encounters, and you start, you know, the idea in that style of organizing is that you listen and start to hear the same things over and over again. So obviously in 1950s, 1960s, South, the things you hear are the obvious ones. Voting, segregation, economic inequality. And then you start to bring people together, and the powerful thing of bringing people together is first and foremost, they realize they're not alone. Oh, you think that too? I didn't know that. And as that happens and you bring people together first in small groups and then in larger groups, you watch as an organizer, you watch and observe. And you notice things like, oh, when Ted talks, people kind of perk up and lean in. Well, he's a candidate to move into a more official, formal role of leadership. And you notice someone else, you notice that, they seem to have good things to say, but they're not really confident. So that's someone who needs to be brought along a little more. And then you eventually build that up and you get a whole town together. Or in the case of the civil rights movement, you do this long enough, you get a big enough group that you can turn out tens of thousands of people to a march. So you are well spotted to notice that this is a powerful and effective model for church leadership, quite apart from political activism.
Maybe you are, or maybe you aren't pointing toward this, but it's possible that you need both of these approaches, because some people will only follow a charismatic leader and be activated by them, and other people will absolutely resist a charismatic leader almost on principle.
Yeah, I mean, the thing to say isn't that, Martin Luther King Jr. was unnecessary or unimportant. It's just to sort of contextualize his importance and to recognize all that goes, the reason the metaphor is used so often and has become trite is because it's actually true. The iceberg, right? He's the tip of the iceberg that you see floating above the waterline, but all these other folks doing all these other things are the main mass of the mass movement that is almost entirely below water.
I'm thinking about what's going on in the universities today, as far as all the protesting. And when we look at this and you see the foundation being so broadly built and deeply built over years and years, and then what's happening now? I know there is a real moral issue at the bottom all of it, but it feels like people are just piling on the top of it somehow. And I don't know if you want to say anything about that. It's a different topic, but it's not a different topic. It's a topic about people being mistreated and unfairly positioned, I guess. So I don't know. We know how to be mean to each other pretty well.
That's a funny way to put it. Not entirely wrong. I'll set aside trying to disentangle the Gordian knot of Israel and Palestine and Jews and Muslims and Hamas and the IDF and all that, and just talk about the campus actions themselves. I think one of the things that we're seeing with the campus actions is the challenges and roadblocks that pop up when the response to the issue is sort of the beginning of the activism and the organizing. So you're trying to build a network and a community. You're trying to build the plane while you're flying it. So most of these actions are not, hey, there's this student group that has been meeting for years and years and years, has built up credibility with the administration, connections with off-campus communities, and is now out of that, the phrase we'll learn to use from SNCC is that relational power, that's the power you build one-to-one, is now applying that to this issue. It's rather that this issue has, set the world on fire and people are trying to respond, but they're responding sort of from zero. There's not a whole lot of pre-existing organizations and relational power. So they're, trying these encampments, they're trying these sit-ins, they're trying these other things, and they're meeting this. Sure. Mm-hmm. Last one.
Yeah, most of my working career was in large corporations. And your right-hand column fits almost exactly on the principles of successful companies. So it's far beyond churches.
Sure. Yeah, I'm maybe outside of the military where there's a very clear need for command and control. I think, you know, if you're going to build an organization and a leadership culture, you know, the right-hand column is probably the more long-term sustainable, long-term successful. I mean, you see this in certain startup culture, right? So you have the charismatic founder who codes the thing at midnight for 10 years to make Facebook or Twitter or you know, whatever. And then at a certain point, the company launches, they make $1 billion. And then what happens? You know, how does it, and the ones that endure build leadership and culture beyond the founder. And the ones that sort of sputter and decline or die are the ones where once that person cashes out, it's like, hey, I made my money, good luck. Well, there's nothing left to sustain development of product and customer service. One more, and then we'll let everybody go.
Two thoughts. I've always wondered if the Baptist Church of Martin Luther King influenced him in terms of what you're describing. And then the second thing I was going to say is that one of the things I think we saw was his, of course, it was so tragic and sudden death, is that there was no one there to step up. Mm-hmm. If you have that kind of bureaucratic, mm-hmm. you know, dominant leadership, then even if the people retire or move on, mm-hmm. you don't have that groundswell of possible other leadership coming in.
Yeah, I think the leadership style of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is very much influenced by Baptist church culture, where the pastor is the boss and, you know, they stand up there and say things and then everyone else is like, okay, we now have to raise this money to do this thing because, you know, pastor said. And so given that the leaders who come together to found the Southern Christian Leadership Conference are born and bred by nature and trained and called by nurture through their ordination process, it's not surprising that the style of leadership in their organization reflects the style of leadership from their congregations. Well, it's a tick past 10:45. Our time has expired. Thanks much for a lively and lovely conversation. We will be back here same time, same bat time, same bat channel next week, and we'll start looking more specifically at some of the events leading up to and that are part of the longer and larger movement. Yes. Yep, absolutely.